From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR's correspondents from around the globe. I'm Kevin Beasley. This week, Israeli concerns about Iran, corruption in Hong Kong, and searching for ivory in Beijing. Concerns are growing in Israel over Iran's suspected nuclear weapons program. The issue is likely to dominate forthcoming talks between Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and President Obama in Washington. NPR's Lourdes Garcia-Navarro visited the Israeli city of Tel Aviv to gauge concern among residents there.
So it's a sunny day in Tel Aviv today, and the waves are crashing against the rocks, and the cafes and the restaurants around me here in the port are packed full of diners. This doesn't feel like a city that's jittery about war.
A group of women are perusing a menu nearby.
I'm wondering what your feeling is on if you're worried about Iran.
Iran?
Iran.
No?
No. We have fun. We meet after a long time.
Yeah, it's not on our main entrance today. We're having fun today.
Israel's leaders, though, have been talking about a possible conflict. In recent comments, Israel's defense minister, Ehud Barak, had this to say about the fallout of any possible war with Iran. If we reach a situation of war, Barak says, there will not be 100,000 casualties. There's no way to avoid certain damage, and it will be unpleasant. But in any scenario, there will not even be 500 casualties, he says. His statement came under fire here by lawmakers and analysts who charge that the Israeli government is not adequately preparing its people for a war, which some say, if it happens, could last years.
Not sufficient, not complete.
That's Uzi Rubin's estimation on the current state of preparation inside Israel. He's a former head of the Israeli missile defense program for the military here.
The main threat on Israel now, the main military threat, is asymmetric war on the home front, meaning missiles and rockets on our home front. The battlefield being taken into the streets of our cities instead of the frontiers.
Military officials here say there are as many as 200,000 missiles and rockets aimed at Israel at any given time. Uzi Rubin says that after the 2006 Lebanon war, it became apparent that Israeli towns and cities that came under fire were completely unprepared. So the Civil Defense Ministry was formed, and for the past 5 years, it's been putting the plans and the protection in place to help shield the population in event of another conflict.
You have to shelter homes, schools, factories. It's a tremendous amount of money. There is no hope that Israel or any country can afford a complete passive defense for its citizens. But still, I think between affordability and what we have right now is still a gap. We need to do more in sheltering, and we need to do more in active defense.
By active defense, he means a missile defense program that can intercept incoming projectiles. Israel has four different systems in place that can deal with a range of threats, second only to the United States. But again, budgets are tight here. Even systems such as the much-vaunted Iron Dome, which protects against short- and medium-range rockets and even mortars from places like Gaza, hasn't been adequately deployed. There are less than half a dozen batteries in place, Uzi Rubin says. But despite the shortfalls, strides have been made in recent years to make sure Israelis can deal with another war. There have been multiple drills across the country simulating all kinds of attacks. Emergency staff has been trained and local leaders appointed to keep things running. It's all having an effect. Even though the cafes in Tel Aviv are crowded, so is this emergency distribution center in the city. People here are lining up for supplies.
I came to take gas masks for the future to come, for the dangers ahead of us.
Ayelit Sela is a 30-year-old video editor. While some in Israel are shrugging off worries of a potential conflict, others here are expecting and preparing for the worst. Lourdes Garcia-Navarro, NPR News.
Coming up, corruption in Hong Kong and searching for ivory in Beijing. This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Kevin Beasley. The race for Hong Kong's next leader has heated up. An underground pleasure palace and allegations of extramarital affairs and the extravagant use of private jets are all making headlines. As the local press puts it, Beijing has lost control of the puppet strings. NPR's Louisa Lim sent this report.
In the past, elections to pick Hong Kong's leader have been sedate affairs. A hand-picked selection of the great and good has endorsed Beijing's choice in what's basically a rigged election. But not this time. With Beijing apparently judging two of three candidates acceptable, there are signs it's turning into something like a real race, with the result unknown and the process beset by mudslinging and scandal. Here's Emily Lau, acting chairperson of the Democratic Party.
The struggle between the two camps is exceedingly fierce and very bloody, very acrimonious. And you can say it's a bomb, you can say it's bloodletting, whatever you say would not be exaggerating. We are tomorrow.
This is a campaign ad for Henry Tang, the former head of the civil service. Initially, he was considered a shoo-in for the next leader. Then it emerged he'd cheated on his wife, and he had to apologise in public. That sound was to become familiar. Here he's heard apologising again. He's admitted to building an illegal 2,000-square-foot pleasure palace in his basement. With a wine cellar and a Japanese sauna, it's reported to be four times the size of the average apartment. He blamed his long-suffering wife. Public opinion turned against him. One voter, the honorary chairman of the pro-business Liberal Party, James Teen, says he can't ignore that.
When we see a situation when our preferred candidate has 70-80% of the population objecting to that, we feel that even if he's elected, he cannot govern effectively. We feel that the only choice we probably have now is either not to cast a vote or to cast a blank vote.
Hong Kong needs new hopes and a new outlook. We need
that's contender number two, Leung Chun-ying, but he's in trouble too. He's being investigated for a conflict of interest over his role as the judge of a design competition. Seen as a reformer, he's popular among the public, but not among Hong Kong's super-rich tycoons. And now political troubles have engulfed the current chief executive, Donald Chang, too. He apologised for his behaviour today. He's accused of accepting inappropriate favours from tycoons, including trips on private jets. Speaking through a translator, he pled for understanding.
You may or may not have lost faith in me, but please do not lose your faith in the institution of Hong Kong.
That shows just how damaging these scandals are. It's not about the money, it's about the idea of collusion between the government and tycoons. Here's analyst Jean-Pierre Cabestan from the Baptist University.
All those things may lead a number of Hong Kong people to the conclusion that the political elite is not independent from the tycoons, but working for the tycoons rather than Hong Kong society.
Public anger is swirling with small protests. This could yet explode into larger street action. Albert Ho is warning there could be fallout from the contentious race. He's the third candidate in the election. He's from the Democratic Party and has no chance of winning.
Whoever is going to win, his governance would face severe credibility crisis. So much antagonism has arisen as a consequence of this recent negative campaign. It's very bad for Hong Kong.
The 1,200 voters will choose Hong Kong's next leader on March the 25th. Many are now waiting for a signal from Beijing. It ultimately will have to choose between alienating the ordinary people of Hong Kong or alienating its tycoons. Louisa Lim, NPR News Hong Kong.
Meanwhile, China's growing hunger for resources is driving both demand and prices, and not just for energy and minerals. As purchasing power has exploded, more Chinese have been implicated in smuggling and selling ivory from Africa. NPR's Frank Langford sent us this report from Beijing.
So I'm here right now at an antique market in the southern part of Beijing. There are these big stone lions outside, and we've gotten some tips that as many as seven, maybe many more, stores here are selling ivory, and I'm with my assistant, Yang.
Hi.
And we're going to go and split up and try to talk to as many people as we can and try to find some ivory. This is how much?
Right?
15,000.
15,000?
Is it? I browse through shops, but I'm the only foreign face here. Sellers eye me warily. No one will show me any ivory.
So we're back out here. It's about an hour later. Yang, what'd you find?
I visited 9 shops, out of which 4 sell ivory products. I saw some necklaces, some bracelets.
And was this stuff openly displayed, or was it somewhere else?
They were hidden in some boxes.
The International Fund for Animal Welfare cased the same mall in November. They found more than 20 shops selling illegal ivory. Grace Gabriel is the group's Asia regional director. She grew up here in Beijing. And Gabriel says Chinese aren't just buying more ivory these days. They're also pushing up prices.
We really didn't anticipate the price that we are seeing today. In raw elephant tusk price, we have seen it tripled in the past year.
From as little as $270 a pound to more than $900 a pound. Ivory has long been a status symbol in China, but Gabriel says rising incomes are driving even greater demand. With China's housing market in decline and the stock market a crapshoot, the nation's super rich are looking for other places to invest their cash.
A lot of them now are looking at collectibles and artifacts, particularly of things that they see as holding value.
Gabriel says illegal ivory sales are rampant online. She taps her computer keyboard and goes to Baidu, China's giant search engine.
If I put in Xiangya, it means elephant ivory. This whole forum, every listing, it's got hundreds of pages, and every single one has ivory on them.
Most ivory here comes from Africa. Authorities around the world seized more than 500 smuggled tusks last year. Among the seizures was one in August in Hong Kong, where customs found nearly 800 pieces of elephant tusk. Kenyan TV reported a similar bust in November.
Export documents revealed that the 87 pieces of contraband ivory belonged to Camtrade East Africa and were being exported to Guangdong Kapo Metal Company in Hong Kong.
Esmond Martin is a world expert in the ivory trade. When I met him last year at his home in Nairobi, he said Chinese workers living in Africa are also driving demand. Many come to the continent to build roads and help China extract oil and minerals. As far back as 2005, Martin found them buying ivory in northern Sudan.
The ivory was moving up to Khartoum, and 75% of the buyers were Chinese.
What were they buying?
Chinese type of things, which are chopsticks and name seals. Plus, they like small animals like hippos, figurines of hippos. I actually photographed them buying some of these items.
Steve Trent says China knows there's a problem and is trying to do something about it. Trent is co-founder of WildAid, a global conservation group.
They are making seizures at airports like Beijing and Shanghai, where much of the ivory is now coming in and entering the marketplace.
But Trent says China's government, which refused to talk to NPR for this story, needs to do more. And groups like his have to convince Chinese people to stop buying ivory. WildAid has targeted thousands of Shanghai and Beijing taxis with ads like this. Yao Ming, the former Houston Rockets basketball star, leaps up and blocks a bullet fired at an elephant. That's Chinese for when the buying stops, then the killing will too. There are signs these awareness efforts are having an impact. At another Beijing antique market, where smuggled ivory is also sold, Wang Xiaofei is browsing for furniture with a friend. Wang is 26 years old, a massage therapist from rural central China. When I was young, he tells me, I didn't know anything of elephant ivory. I lived in the countryside. But as Wang grew up, he saw things that got him thinking. From documentaries and Discovery Channel, I learned about elephants, he says. They're beautiful, graceful, and very protective of their families. Seeing elephants killed really hurts me emotionally. Now, Wang says, it seems like such a waste to kill these extraordinary creatures for their tusks. A key to protecting elephants going forward is to get more people in China to start thinking the same way. Frank Langfitt, NPR News, Shanghai.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Beasley.